Responding to a PR RFP can be stressful, time-consuming, and sometimes futile. But it's also necessary, as RFPs are a staple of agency business development efforts. So how can we engage the RFP process and live to tell about it? Our guests today are here to answer that question. Robert Udowitz and Steve Drake are principals of the firm RFP Associates, based here in D.C. They've been working the past several years to help organizations improve their RFP process to the benefit of people looking for agencies and the PR teams competing for work. Here's Robert's PR Summer School conversation with the RFP experts, Steve Drake and Robert Udowitz.
Request for proposals. Those three words, when taken together, often strike fear in the hearts of PR pros everywhere. So the first question is, why?
Well, because, and it strikes fear, Robert, on both sides of the coin. So it strikes fear with clients because they oftentimes dread doing these. They oftentimes use shortcuts, and we found that out in recent research we did. And it really strikes fear in the hearts of agencies. We've had many agencies tell us, you know, I'm not going to respond to another RFP. That usually sparks a level of distrust. This is probably wired for some agency, and they're just they're issuing an RFP to sort of cover their backsides or make procurement happy. And so, you know, what we found, both sides have real issues with it. And principally, it's because of the way the process is carried out. The RFP, we wouldn't have named our company RFP Associates if we thought the RFP was inherently evil. So it really is the way that the document and the way that the process is implemented that strikes fear, as you correctly put it.
I think it's also one of the reasons why we began our business. We recognized that there was a need to improve the process. Both Steve and I have worked on the agency and corporate side, associations as well, and we knew how the struggle it was to respond to RFPs when you work for an agency and to also identify the correct agencies and write an RFP to find the right agency. Plus, in the early stages when we first began, I had come across a lot of people that had just hired agencies and weren't satisfied with them. And after 3 months, they were already prepared to remove them. And the process was clearly broken. And I knew there was a way that we probably could correct the problem.
When I did PR for the government, I had the luxury of delegating that exercise to people on the team. But I've definitely been in the pitch mode many times. And just so many things that you've touched on very lightly, I'd like to get into quickly, that are wrong with the process. Let's talk about some of those. The RFPs aren't written well.
The RFPs aren't written well, and more often than not, Robert, they don't contain basic information. And we always say to clients, if your RFP is prompting more questions than it's answering in terms of providing adequate background, providing, what is the core scope of work that the client expects out of the agency, that should be in there. With all of our clients, we insist that there's budget parameters in there. This notion of you tell me how much I need to spend on you, agency, is just malarkey.
Frustrating.
So, you know, the RFP needs to contain all information that an agency is going to be able to use to put its best foot forward in a response, whether that's a written, you know, proposal or a presentation or both.
And the RFP needs to have transparency. That to us is one of the other number one goals in our process. There's no reason to hide elements from the agencies that are going to be competing against each other. They need to know the timeline. They need to know the decision-making. They need to know who's on the selection team. They need to know who the other agencies are that they're competing against. This notion that RFPs have to be sent out sort of incognito and not sort of provide information to every agency and make it more of a guessing game just sort of damages the process and really sort of, we think, hinders the client from really getting the best information from agencies.
I think you mentioned it, Steve. Agencies don't want to play the game.
No, they don't. And some actually have vowed that they will not, you know, respond to another RFP. Having said that, you know, our friends at the PR Council, which is an association of some of the medium to large size, you know, PR agencies, has said that, you know, up to 30% of all new business among their members is generated via an RFP process. it probably is not the smartest idea to, you know, just outright refuse to respond to any RFPs. We always counsel agencies that if there isn't adequate information, they should continue to ask questions until they have the information they need to adequately respond. If that information is refused, then perhaps they should walk away.
And Robert, the idea here is that a lot of business is awarded through this process, so it makes sense to try to move it from dysfunctional to functional.
100%. I mean, you want to hire an agency that you're going to have a long-term relationship with. And unless you provide them or empower them with all the information and knowledge that they need to respond adequately to your RFP, then basically you're sort of self-damaging the process and your own organization. Steve and I always talk about the fact that you're hiring an agency that's going to ultimately represent your organization externally. So if you're not putting your best foot forward and hiring the best firm, it's very difficult to ensure that you're getting that done through the process.
Why do you think the process has become or has historically been a secret? Why is it a secretive process, largely?
I'm really not sure, other than just that's the way it's always been done. And, you know, there's the secret. I mean, one of the things, for example, to jump ahead, one of the things that, you know, in the spirit of openness that Robert referred to a few minutes ago, once the RFP has been distributed, the first thing that we do is tell our clients they ought to hold an open conference call. So every agency knows who they're competing against. They all ask the questions in front of each other, telephonically at least. They all know who each other is. And we've had, in some cases, agencies drop out because they realize who their competitors are. It raises so many eyebrows when we suggest that, when we suggest things like putting the budget in the RFP, you know, again, letting agencies know who they're competing against. So I think it's simply the fact that that's the way it's always been done. I think that, you know, perhaps their, you know, clients are taking cues from other RFPs that have been issued for other services or products. I'm not really sure, but we think it's folly.
I think that the RFP process has gotten to the state where it's at just by sheer mass. More and more agencies have come about, have been built. The industry has grown so much. For decades now, an RFP process per se has been sort of put onto the blackboards, and that's the way it's done. There's no governing body that sort of says this is the right way and prescribe the correct manner and outline to actually produce an RFP. So in our own little world, we're trying to sort of accomplish that by putting our clients on the right sort of track in order to really hire the best agency. And we really feel that when we get on our soapboxes, we'll really improve the industry by improving the process to select an agency. And we just think there's been that void right now that somebody needs to sort of come in and sort of fulfill.
How long have you been doing that?
We've been doing it now about 6 or 7 years.
And have you seen an improvement in this process, not just with your own clients, but overall?
Only with our own clients.
Only with your own.
That's why everybody should hire us, right?
No, I mean, there are all the time people are emailing us and showing us an RFP that's been sent to them, complaining about a recent proposal that they've written and how it's not been accepted or the process that they've gone under. And we just feel that we know we can fix that. And it's not just because we want to build our business and grow our own economic model. It's also because we really feel that there's something there that people are not understanding and not really knowing.
Some of the best feedback, Robert, that we've received has been from agencies, even those who have not won, you know, the business that for which we've, you know, been a, you know, party to. And they'll call us up and they'll compliment us on, you know, that was the fairest, you know, most equitable RFP process I've ever been through. And thank you. And so that positive feedback is almost as good as the check we get from our clients, you know, after the fact. But I hope we've, you know, over time we're starting to have an influence, perhaps, as and we'll talk. We can talk about the research that we just completed as well. But it so far, I think we haven't seen a groundswell of change in the RFP process in public relations. Unfortunately,
everybody wants change, but I think everyone's looking towards someone to make that change, and we just hope that we're able to contribute and make it happen.
You've talked about the budget a couple of times. I feel like that is one of the biggest missing pieces in almost every RFP that we see. And when you ask, often the issuer doesn't want to say. it's really hard to come up with a plan that you can deliver upon if you're not sure how much they've got to spend. You know, should I give them $1 million plan or a $50,000 plan?
Well, that's exactly right. And I think they do themselves a disservice if they refuse to include budget information. Taking a step back, I think one of the most important services that my partner Robert and I, you know, provide to clients is to basically sit down and talk about two things at the same time, scope of work and budget. And we can start with either. And they want to spend X, then we talk about scope of work. And again, given our background on both the agency side and the client side, we're able to say, what you've budgeted, you're not even going to begin to be able to pay for this very, you know, ambitious scope of work. And so there's a bit of a negotiation process, and this all goes to writing the core document, the RFP document. And I think that's where there's such a disconnect. So if a client does issue an RFP with an ambitious scope of work, but no budget parameters or direction, and then they get back that, you know, these agencies want $50,000, $75,000, $100,000 a month, then they fall off their chairs. Well, again, they've done themselves a disservice.
So when we speak before clients and we give a presentation about really the right way they should structure their RFP and include their budget, we ask them, what do they think the average blended rate is for an agency nationwide? And most of them don't know. I mean, the current rate is roughly about 170 to 190 as a blended rate. But you have to do the math and start realizing that very quickly the hours add up. Before you know it, it could reach the $50,000 a month level based on the work that you need. The other piece of it, I think, too, is that too many clients maybe are used to their own home shopping experiences, and they want to get a bargain for everything. So they feel that if they just shop for agencies, they'll find an agency that'll give them the right price, rather than realizing that they need to provide that budget so an agency can then break it down and recognize, do you want the Cadillac of skill sets and staff allotment, or do you just need something, you know, a little bit more modest and mid-level that you can still get the job done, but without as much ambition? It's perfectly reasonable, but the budget needs to be set up forward.
That disconnect between scope and budget to me is like PR's version of the ice bucket challenge. You know, you're saying you want all of these things. You come in, you give them a scope that, or a set of ideas that matches the scope, and then we start talking about money, and like you said, they fall off their chairs. It almost qualifies as a huge waste of time.
Well, you're right. And we see it a lot, particularly in clients that want international work. They don't understand how quickly those numbers change and how different it is per country. So that whole notion just sort of boggles their mind. And when we try to educate them beforehand, we come to a compromise so we can put a dollar amount on the RFP, in the RFP, but ultimately things sort of change as the agencies also start to educate them about what it costs to do something in this country in Asia or in this part of Europe or this part of Africa, depending on what the client may want.
Talking about the RFP process as it relates to the written document, I can think of numerous times when I've been sitting in that final pitch, talking to the actual client contacts, and realizing that none of them had anything to do with the document I replied to. Is that a problem?
Well, it is. And in fact, part of the process that we advocate, I call us RFP cops, Robert, and more than anything else. I always say what we do is not necessarily rocket science, but is perhaps RFP law enforcement, right? And so one of the things we do from the get-go, along with, you know, working out the scope of work and the budget, et cetera, with the client, is to say, okay, let's figure out who your evaluation team on the client side is going to be, because we're going to put them to work. We're going to put them to work in two ways. We're going to put them to work in reviewing the incoming proposals, and we actually create a scorecard to ensure that everybody's sort of looking at the proposals on an apples-to-apples, oranges-to-oranges basis. And we're, those same people are going to be expected at the ultimate, you know, the presentations, because you're absolutely right. I mean, to bring in sort of the big bosses for the finalist presentations and they have no clue or context is again, ends up being a big waste of time on the client side for sure.
We want our clients to build an internal team that goes outside of their communications department for most of the RFPs and agency searches we do. We want to make sure that people that are going to be vested in the process are part of the process and they're prepared every step of the way and they recognize the hours it also takes to review each of the proposals that are provided. So it boils down to that And as Steve mentioned, the scorecard is a critical piece of that, to have a uniform scorecard that takes into consideration every element of what was asked for in the proposal, or even for a scorecard we prepare for the presentation that takes in every element of what's required during a presentation, ultimately will help them sort of come to the right consensus.
There's one other, I was just going to add, there's one other element that we didn't mention here a few minutes ago. We actually NDA protect RFPs. By that, I mean non-disclosure agreements. So before we issue an RFP, we ask the agencies to sign a non-disclosure agreement that protects them, frankly, that sort of promises that the client is not going to steal their ideas and tell them to go away, but also protects the client against any potential conflict, et cetera, et cetera. The reason we do that is that, you know, if a company is hiring a public relations firm to represent their brand, their reputation, we think the good and the bad and the ugly ought to go into that RFP. There ought to be sensitive information that the agency needs to promise ahead of time they're not going to disclose the contents of the RFP to anyone else beyond people responding to the RFP. So that makes for, again, more complete information that the agencies consume, but it also protects both sides. So I just wanted to make that point.
And it was also a primary concern of most agencies. You asked them, and they're concerned about putting their best foot forward because they're concerned about proprietary information that could be stolen, and they feel that they've experienced, or they've heard of other agencies that have experienced having their good ideas taken, and they see it being implemented by the client in a later form. We think that the use of an NDA as part of the process really, once again, elevates it and makes it a better process overall for both sides in RFP and agency selection.
The RFP process has that reputation, and in fact, the agency that I run, we experienced that a few months ago. We didn't win, and within 6-8 weeks, we saw one of our ideas that we knew was ours on the street. That's very frustrating.
Well, it is, Robert. That leads directly to, you know, this continuing distrust and dysfunction in the process overall. I mean, because those stories, I'm sure you'll tell that story to other agencies, to your competitors as well as you know, your friends. And that, unfortunately, it does happen. It shouldn't happen. I hope in the future it doesn't happen. If we continue to kind of proselytize as we are with you right now about a good RFP process.
But that's also what we say to agencies as well. When we speak before that audience, we emphasize to them not only should they be selective with the RFPs they choose, but they should demand that protection for themselves. We want to create that sort of movement that has agencies requesting an NDA, because a lot of times clients aren't even issuing an NDA for their own protection. We feel that it should be an agency also protecting it, so it's a both-way written document.
It's definitely needed, because I think I can recall at least one or two instances over five different agencies I've worked in or helped run where winning led to, in the kickoff meeting, a stack of competitive proposals being handed over for mining of ideas. And that is just so unethical. I mean, we refused, but it was being offered.
Good for you for refusing it, but it is unethical, I would agree.
I'm not surprised. It saddens me, but I'm not surprised. But once again, an NDA is such a simple extra piece to include in an RFP. Why can't it be done universally?
You find that the clients you work with, when you suggest that, they go along?
Yeah, they actually welcome it. That's one thing that doesn't raise an eyebrow.
Well, they'll get better ideas.
Well, they will. They'll get richer, better ideas from the agency candidates that are submitting proposals.
They recognize it, and they also feel that there's more trust and more of a connection that they're having with the agencies. Keep in mind, our process doesn't include multiples of agencies. By the time agencies receive an RFP on our watch, there's only about 8 or 10 competing. So a lot of times agencies are also competing against 10, 20, maybe more agencies. So this also adds to the management of a good RFP.
I feel like as we've gone through my personal therapy session here about RFPs that we've covered a lot of the topics that would be important for the issuer of an RFP to remember. But we'll try to summarize both sides of this. Let's start there again. If I am looking to issue an RFP, I'm in-house, I'm running the process, I need an agency to help me, what are some of the tips that you would offer here that you can share without sending me a bill that would help me do a better job. Have we missed anything? Is there anything that we would need to add, or do you just want to summarize those high points?
On the client side, we recommend with starting with an RFQ. We feel it's very important to choose the agencies that are going to be candidates for your RFP by first learning more about the agencies and making a very simple form that agencies can fill out to tell them what area of expertise they have, what clients they currently represent, what conflicts they may have. This is all before they know who the client is. So we, under RFP Associates, issue an RFQ and request a number of agencies, it could be 30, could be 40 agencies, to give us some simple answers that we feel that they have an expertise and they should be able to respond to, so we can determine which ones are the best for our client. And we describe in very broad strokes who our client is, essentially what the budget is expected to be, so they understand we're not just simply fishing for information. And we request the information, look at the responses, and then we choose the agency. So we think an RFQ is a very important first step for any good agency selection process.
Request for qualifications is what RFQ stands for.
And RFI, request for information, yes.
So, I mean, I think the other, to address your question, Robert, the other thing, you know, we do, even before we issue that RFQ, is we basically sit down with a client and say, okay, you need an agency. Why? Let's talk about, are you replacing an existing agency? Is this the first time you've hired an agency? Getting into that scope of work, who's going to manage the agency? So we get into a bit of a therapy session with our clients from the get-go, sort of like, you understand this. You know, I always liken hiring an agency like bringing on 10 people all at once, right? I mean, now those people, those account people are not necessarily working full-time every day for you, but effectively it takes management, it takes time. Even before we get into the selection process, are you prepared for this marriage, or you know, this contract? So I think number one, sitting down and sort of assessing what are the needs and how are they going to manage this agency relationship for which they've hired us to do, you know, to help them.
Right. First, we have to make sure that they have the bandwidth to really manage the agency, because so many clients go into the process without really thinking any of this through. So that's important. And what Steve mentioned, I think, much earlier in our conversation, was we help our client determine what their real scope of work is. What are their goals? What are their objectives? Everyone talks about that, but when you finally put it on paper, then you really start committing yourself. You know, you're putting the rubber hits the road, and we sort of help them come through that entire process. And we've learned over time that clients don't necessarily know what they want, which is also what's inherently wrong with the RFP process, because clients are choosing agencies and the agency starts on day one not knowing what to do. And part of that is because it really hasn't been thought out too well in the beginning.
So many times, the excitement of winning is completely overwhelmed by the inertia of not getting any direction, not being able to schedule the first meeting, not being able to get decisions. I've worked in agencies before where we've lost a client because of that very problem. They look back at you and say, well, what have you been doing for the last 3 months other than sending invoices, trying to get action?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we talk about, you know, search and selection and RFQs and RFPs, and that's all fine and good. But one of the most important, if not the most important step, is the onboarding process, which is really what you're referring to. And so, again, that's part of that initial discussion. Not only, you know, how are you going to manage this agency and do you have the bandwidth, but what are you going to do initially? You know, you need to dedicate the time initially to do that. The other thing I think is worth mentioning here is that clients sometimes look at, when we put together an RFP with them, they'll look at that almost like the contract. And we basically say, look, the RFP is really a test of sort of the strategic thinking, creativity of the agency candidates and the budget as well. They get really concerned. Oh, I don't know if we're ultimately going to spend $20,000, $30,000 a month. You hope that it somewhat matches, but we always explain to them the contracting process, which is part of the onboarding, right, doesn't necessarily have to match word for word what's in that RFP. I've worked at a number of agencies, as has Robert. I can't tell you one time when the program that we ultimately, if we won a piece of business as a result of an RFP, the program looked anything like what we had proposed. So I think that's an important piece of this as well. The onboarding and the contracting is a very important step, but it's apart and separate from what's in that RFP.
Which is why many times we ask an agency in their proposal to say what's their first day looking like. What did they want to do? How did they want to start? setting the timeline. What's there? What are the elements in the proposal that make that leap and move forward?
Are they equipped to manage the agency? When you have 8 or 9 people working on your behalf, that generates a lot of decision points. And if it's all falling on one person who has many other responsibilities in addition to this, all of a sudden things come to a stop.
Well, that's exactly right. And in many cases, we will actually suggest to our clients that they ask, as part of the RFP, for some help in that regard from the competing agencies. What do I mean by that? Put another way, when Robert and I are speaking before agencies, we tell them, in your proposals, don't forget the boring stuff. It isn't all about grandiose, creative, breakthrough ideas, right? Whether that's social media strategies or otherwise. Tell the client how you're going to manage the team. Tell the client how often you will want to meet with them, have conference calls. And so that's part of the RFP, at least as we help our clients write them, is, and clients are concerned about that because they do realize they're all of a sudden going to have all these decision points and 8 or 10 people running around representing them out there to the news media, et cetera, et cetera. So having an administrative section, as boring as it might be for them to write or for our clients to read, I think is very, very key.
That's a good transition to the other side of the fence, which is the agency that responds to the RFP. What are some things for people in those positions to keep in mind?
Well, I mean, I think that they need to always put their best foot forward. I mean, it gets back a little bit to the NDA piece of it, but they also have to remember that for the client, it's all about them. So often we read responses and we're opening up the first 10, 15 pages and it's about the agency and how great they are. Client wants to open up a proposal and read about what's going to be done for them, what it's about for them, what the agency envisions them being able to do for the client, and learning the step-by-step process. And then they want to hear a little bit more of the background. We've come to this point where the agency has been selected as a candidate. You know, we want to know more about, you know, what you're going to do for me and what exactly you're proposing.
To add to that, I always suggest to agencies that they include provable creativity in their proposals. What do I mean by that? What I mean by that is great ideas are great. But if you don't demonstrate to a client that you have tried something like that or a derivation of that idea and it's worked.
Is it possible?
I mean, my favorite example, I did some work in my background in the education world, and everybody would sort of come in, if we want to get to kids, we're going to go in and help schools do a new lesson plan on drugs, pharmaceuticals, whatever it might be. It's almost impossible, right, for an outsider to influence in this day and age, you know, K-12 or high school or whatever curriculum. So that's an example of, it might be a great idea to sort of, you know, inculcate kids into whatever the subject is, but it ain't going to happen. Creativity is great. Good strategic thinking is great. What's even greater is if that is twinned with, and we've done this very thing for either another client in we don't longer have in your sector or for even a client in a totally different sector.
Showing the measurement also is critical too. Don't just simply come up with the ideas, but show how you're going to track each step of the way and be able to have a measurable result, because that's what clients are all about these days. It's the ROI. It's how we're going to get from one point to the next. So an agency has to instinctively demonstrate that as far as what they're going to be presenting to a client.
Which kind of RFP do the two of you prefer? One that is extremely prescriptive? Fill in these blanks, follow this order, do it this way, number each section exactly the way we've done it with Roman numerals, or one that's a little more free-flowing, kind of like the essay question at the end of a test. I've seen both.
I'll answer that question by saying a little bit of both, Robert. We like each proposal that we're going to receive to be structured in a similar fashion. And so we do prescribe sort of a structure. Having said that, what we hope we do is through the RFP itself is to give them the core scope of work, but still give them the license to be flexible and give them the freedom. Because really what we're trying to test for there on behalf of clients is, what is the strategic thinking behind this particular idea? What is the idea itself? What's the strategic thinking behind that? How does the agency propose to achieve that idea? And do they have demonstrated experience that proves that they can achieve it? So we're not about fill in the blanks, et cetera, et cetera. We are, however, frankly, to make it easier for the evaluation team on the client side to get through 6, 8 proposals. We are about structuring and telling them what we want, you know, how we want that ordered. That makes it more effective and easier for the client to sort of evaluate.
From the agency perspective again, what are some warning signs if I get an RFP that I might notice and act upon? In other words, I see one, what am I looking for? How do I know whether it's a good RFP or one I might take a pass on?
Well, it's got to be thorough. And we always advise agencies to be selective and really to establish, really even before they receive an RFP, what kind of business are they after? And not to try to shoehorn their expertise into a response to an RFP. Agencies are always complaining about how much time, how much money it really takes for them to, you know, to actually respond to an RFP. So why waste the time, we tell them, if they're just pretending they can do the work? If they can't substantively show that they have the expertise, the experience, the clientele, then just don't go after it. That's, I think, the first thing. We also tried to enforce a bit of an agency bill of rights. We tell agencies when we speak with them too, that they should demand certain things up front inside the RFP. It includes the budget, of course. It includes the NDA, as we're saying too, if there's information that they need to receive and to get.
Well, yeah, we have a slide in one of our presentations that says, you know, does the RFP pass the sniff test? And if the odor isn't good, improve the odor. And by that we mean ask for, you know, more information, keep asking questions. And again, agencies obviously are reluctant to do that. You know, they don't want to like turn off a prospective client even before they've responded to the RFP. But at the end of the day, it's for their own good and for the own good of their own bottom line to try to improve the odor of that RFP so that they have the right information and they can go do that.
Well, and I alluded to this earlier that one of the other complaints agencies have is that most of these RFPs are cattle calls. They should not be responding to RFPs that go out to multiple agencies that you don't even know their names. If you can't be certain of how many agencies received an RFP, then you really can't be certain towards how many firms you're up against. And anyone in sales will tell you that exponentially, your odds of winning the client are just lower and lower. So why go after something if you can't be certain and empowered with all the information you need before you get ready to prepare your proposal?
Talking about preparing the proposal, a couple of things there I wanted your opinion on. How about length? Does quantity denote quality? Some people think that the bigger the response, the better our chances. Is that true?
Well, they all have to cover their points. When we prepare an RFP for a client, there's X amount of points that are outlined that must be addressed. So I don't think it's necessarily quantity, of course, by any stretch of the means. They tend to run, I would say, well, we've received ones that are pretty extensive, I would say. It all depends on the scope of work and how it has to be addressed. We do encourage some degree of brevity and not leaving out details, but sort of controlling in terms of how detailed responses may be, only because we're trying not to get them into the weeds.
I would offer this piece of advice. You know, it's not necessarily longer, more pages of copy is better, but I would say one thing that is not good is huge graphics that are going to clog up our email or our client's email where they're trying to be impressive with full bleed photographs, et cetera, that take away. They're obviously trying to, you know, have an impact with that, but that in some cases can take away actually from the effectiveness.
Well, we've been sent proposals that are upwards of 75 megabytes of in a document, and we're just like, we can't even download it. I mean, how can we print it, let alone download it, to review what you've sent us? And some of them have shortened it, et cetera. And to Steve's point, some of them have blazing graphics and maybe animations, and some have video in them too. And I can understand why, to some degree, they want to demonstrate certain skills depending on what the RFP may be calling for. On the other aspect, it really boils down to brass tacks, okay? We've got X amount of prescribed things we need to know that you can handle. And you know what? Sometimes it can really just be simply done on several pages of good writing, properly laid out pages so our eyes don't sort of wander and we don't get too tired reading it, and presented to us properly. And also presented to us as it relates to our client with other work that they've done before. And that goes to case studies. That even goes to bios. That also eliminates the notion of having to do everything in sort of a cookie cutter, boilerplate type of way. Things can be customized that make it very relatable to the client. I think not enough agencies do that either.
You talked about keeping the client in mind and writing the RFP response accordingly so that you're talking about them right out of the box. This seems to fall into the category of keeping the panel in mind, because they're looking at 6, 7, 8, 10 RFPs or responses to an RFP. And if there's one that's 150 pages and the others are all 15 or 20, you know, however everyone thinks they ought to respond, have you seen that work against people?
Absolutely. I would say that whether it's in the RFP itself or most certainly in the what we call the bidder's call, which comes immediately following the distribution of the RFP and that NDA and RFP, we remind, you know, the agency candidates of just that. You know, remember, we're all human. Most of the people on this on this end are, you know, are 50 plus. So, you know, make sure that you don't use tiny, tiny type size. And also remember that there are 8 of you on the phone call. We're going to get 8 proposals. And yes, we will read each one thoroughly, but keep that in mind when you're preparing the proposal, that yours may not be the first, it may not be the last, but it's going to be one of perhaps 8, and so to please keep that in mind.
We do scratch our heads sometimes reading responses and saying to ourselves, this is a communications industry. We should be getting responses that are a little bit more succinct, that tell a better story, that really are written a little bit better, are proofread a little bit better, all those little nuances that really could be dings against an agency when we're actually reviewing them.
How about links? Is it okay to include a link and ask someone on the panel, if not all of them, to go follow that? Or should everything be in the document, in the file?
Most of them are PDFs. I tend not to, you can't really print out these huge PDFs like I mentioned to you. I tend to put them onto my iPad, makes it easier, an easier read. So links are easy for me to go to. They have to be relevant. I mean, we've had one or two proposals sent to us that the links that are sent to us are all client testimonials. Well, I don't want to read how good you are. Once again, I want to read what you're going to do for my client. So it all becomes relevant to what we need.
Yeah, I mean, and we don't know. Everyone on the panel may or may not choose to click on the links, but I would also just add that too many links can be distracting. If a reader does go ahead and click on a link and gets taken off, if there's a narrative to the proposal, it's going to interrupt that narrative. So I guess bottom line, the message to the agency would be judicious with links.
I don't know if either of you have seen the material that Jenny Dietrich out of Chicago puts out, but she has this message that she constantly talks about, and that is get out of the RFP game altogether, which sounds great to me. I'd love to do that. One of the things that she highlights is this whole idea of how you list the staff or the team that will work on the account. You know, let's say that you have 6 people in your firm. You're going after a project or a client that's going to bill possibly $2 or $3 million a year. You're going to need to hire more people if you win. You can't list them in the proposal. Now all of a sudden you've shown the client these names when there'll be names coming in that haven't even been interviewed yet. How do you cross that bridge from either side of the RFP question? Have you run into that?
No, we haven't run into that. I would say that probably would be, if it's a 6-person agency, that would probably be an RFP that they probably would not be real wise to respond to, unless they, and we have done this, we have encouraged otherwise capable agencies, if they're not quote unquote big enough to respond. Now that you know who everyone else is you're competing with, if you want to collaborate, that's okay. Let us know that you're going to do that. The RFPs that we get into with our clients are very direct about the fact that we want to know who precisely is going to be working on the business if you win, what is their background, et cetera, et cetera. So if a response comes in that says, you know, these 6 people are going to be working full time and we'll hire another 6 because you guys have a huge account, that's probably not going to fly.
Well, you know, one thing we haven't really mentioned, which I really think is important to your listeners, is that we are agency agnostic. So we are very judicious in terms of finding even agencies that are good for our clients. And we have hired virtual agencies. So we've hired 1-person shops that are able to build teams. We've hired mid-size agencies and large multinational agencies. So it doesn't matter to us who the agency is. It's what they can bring to the table and how they can prove themselves to the client. So I understand 100% where Jenny's coming from, because it's where the industry is coming from. Why doesn't everyone embrace RFPs? We understand that. But we're advocates of RFPs, not just because it's the name of our company and it's really primarily our vehicle to do the work for our clients, but because we think it can be a good process if it's done correctly. So You know, I disagree that we have to get rid of RFPs. We just have to make them better in every way we've described in this conversation.
The first firm I worked for actually was small and won a big state contract in the public health arena. And that was the springboard for its domination in certain areas in the western part of the United States. They had to grow. They had people on the team when they pitched that worked on it, but it really propelled the agency. So that's why I'm asking that question. I feel like if I shy away from a project that's a little bit over my head, that I'll never grow. And that's why I'm asking the question from your perspective, how do you work around that or deal with it? The collaboration is one way, if you're lucky enough to know who you're competing against. And that's not, I wouldn't say that's the norm. I mean, it is with your clients, but most people aren't sharing that. Is there any other way to thread the needle on that question?
Well, this goes a little bit back to the research that we just recently completed. I mean, clients are not looking at enough of a pool of agencies to consider for their work. And we think they do themselves and the industry a disservice. We know there are many qualified people and boutiques out there that can do phenomenal work and are tied into very large networks of very capable people, larger agencies, worldwide agencies that they can use and tap into. So we really think that there's a lot of good there and there's a lot of good resources out there. There's us as agency search experts. There's online databases. We work with a partner communications match. That's a great online resource to find agencies for virtually any sort of stripe and color. And you know, we feel that that's really sort of the best way to make it happen.
How do you feel about the idea of looking through an RFP and going to that issuer saying, this is the part we do. We'd like to talk to you about something different. In other words, you have this massive scope, and presumably you've thought that out. But we're guessing that in the end, you're going to have, you know, some bigger shop doing something. We are really good in this piece of it. Do I need to collaborate, or can I go directly back to that issuer and say, you know, we're going to pass here, but we'd like you to keep us in mind for X, Y, or Z? Have you ever seen that? Making it fit your business model without going through a process that's misleading to everyone involved?
Of sorts. It would be better if it was the other way around. And we have counseled clients in terms of how they think about structuring the ultimate contract for the agency looking ahead. We've counseled them to perhaps let's do this first as a 6-month project. Yes, I mean, I think that could be done. Again, you know, the process that we recommend, that could come out during the bidder's call where somebody could say, this is our area of expertise. We'd like to really focus in on that. Is it okay if we respond to that? Again, we haven't seen that in the clients we've had. It wouldn't be out of the realm of possibility.
And I don't think it's a bad idea for agencies because, once again, it goes back to the amount of hours that they put into responding to an RFP.
Correct.
Okay, if they're going to be smart and they recognize that this isn't for them, but there's a component that they really can sort of hit it out of the ballpark, then they should take the time. They should say something. They've got nothing to lose, and potentially they won't respond to the RFP, but they've put that on the table. And I think it would be very much considered because, going back to the research we recently completed, we know that clients are hiring 3 to 4 to 5 agencies now, not having a single agency of record, okay, which has been a trend for some time. And we think that if a client recognizes that maybe this agency has got that expertise in that one area, I don't think it would be unheard of that we would call it out and just sort of separate it.
And that research was recently published by the Institute for Public Relations. You want to talk about that for a minute and where people can find it?
Sure. We founded RFP Associates based on sort of anecdotal research, if you will, that Robert and I had. We knew that the process was broken, as we've talked about in this conversation. And from the get-go, we wanted to do the kind of research that we were able to just complete for the Institute for Public Relations. Starting earlier this year, we basically identified and went out to, you know, Fortune 1000 chief communications officers and their counterparts at sort of the largest associations and nonprofits. We ended up with, I guess, close to 100, about 90 responses, which the research company we worked with said was more than adequate to be considered valid, et cetera. The responses, Robert, frankly, kind of validated all that anecdotal information that we'd received. So, you know, to give you a couple of headlines or highlights, 2/3 of the respondents said that they start they start the process of looking for a new agency with just 2 to 5 agencies. We ask them, you know, what are your sources of information about these agencies? And they typically would say, my own personal experience or the advice of my peers, presumably other client contacts. And then we dig a little bit deeper in terms of asking specifics about the RFP process, et cetera. And again, not surprisingly, many, many clients, and these are, again, the biggest companies in the United States, are telling us that they are, you know, many of them are not including the budget. Many of them are not including some other basic information. On the flip side, we talked about satisfaction with agencies, and it was interesting. I kind of use the analogy. It's a bit like talking about Congress and your congressman. People might say, oh, I like my congressman. You know, I can't stand Congress. I like my congressman. But then if you ask specific questions about what about the way your congressman voted on that last bill or what about that last tweet that he or she issued, et cetera, then people might have more of a problem. In a similar fashion, most of the folks that we talked to said that they were generally satisfied with their, what we used to call agency of record, the agency with which they had the most significant relationship. But then we sort of drilled down and asked, are you happy with their proactivity? Are you happy with their cost effectiveness, et cetera? And there was less satisfaction there. We also asked similar questions about, were you happy with the process you undertook to hire this? In other words, the RFP process. Most of them said they used RFPs. I think, you know, 2/3 or 3/4 used RFPs. But then again, it was very interesting, particularly the chief communications officers that had agency in their background, who had worked for agencies like yourself. They were less satisfied with the way that they went about doing it. The way they were going about doing it is precisely what we've been talking about in this conversation. And they sort of conceded, didn't spend as much time as we should have doing due diligence, probably should have looked at more agencies, cast a wider net initially. But again, that's how they've been doing it. Relative to their satisfaction with agencies, again, overall they were happy, but certain aspects of their performance they were not. So we tie a lot of this back to, if they improve the process at the front end, they're going to be happier and happier marriage with that agency.
And we connected it all with a bit of a hiring analogy. If they're going to hire a single staffer or a large group of staff, it's going to take them several months to hire up. It's going to take a lot of background checks, a lot of reference checks, a lot of details that we're observing they're not doing when they're hiring an agency. And you can make an argument that since this agency may be the external face of a client of an organization, that indeed they should be spending the same amount of time to hire an agency as they do for an employee. So there's a disconnect, and we're trying to really sort of demonstrate that by showing that there is a larger pool, just like there's a larger pool of employees, there's a larger pool of agencies out there that they should consider and really look at and not just simply go to the same old,
right,
same old. Those same olds could be good. We never eliminate that possibility, but we just think you need to have a larger pool to really sort of get a better perspective and idea and not simply just go back to the old habits.
If a company's going to hire a $500,000 a year executive, chances are they're going to look at more than 2 to 5 resumes, right? Or have their headhunter or their HR department go out and look for that. The equivalent's happening here. They're spending $500,000 or in some cases, well, 1/4 of everybody we talked to said they're spending $1 million or more on their primary agency. And yet they're really beginning the search for that agency with 2 to 5 they're shotgunning out an RFP to. So we shouldn't be in the business of scolding our prospective clients, but I guess we are suggesting to them that there is a better way. And there is, as Robert said, so much information out there, so many good boutique agencies that are cost-effective, that are very, very capable. I think our partner company, Communications Match, has 5,000 agencies and individual consultants in his database currently, and it's growing. So
that research is going to be available on the IPR website. We'll have a link to that in the show notes. People can just go there and click and find it. It's worth reading. It's about 35, 36 pages long, I think, but well-designed, easy to get through.
Thank you.
Hopefully we follow out our own advice.
I hope so. Yeah, it's always good. Hey, you know, that job interviewing process, looking for that employee to bring into the team involves looking for chemistry, and that's kind of where I want to wrap up here. You talk about that also in this process. I think sometimes you can tell on the original call when you start to hear that exchange, but other times it takes all the way to the pitch when you're face-to-face to understand that. Is there anything you can do from either side or both sides of the fence to evaluate that early and maybe save yourself some headaches?
As far as evaluating it early, it doesn't always communicate itself through the proposal. It's really the one-on-one. It's really the reference calls. I mean, we've had reference calls where clients of agencies have just really spoke so highly of the team and of individuals, and they've sort of validated some of what we've already observed through the proposal process. Chemistry is really, it boils down to a lot of that during the presentations. And we really can see how it's not just chemistry between the potential client and the agency, it's even how the agency people, the presentation team, are sort of collaborating, working together. We've seen some tense moments between agency
personnel.
Agency
yeah.
personnel looking at each other, okay? So you can read a lot into that, and you can't bring that to a presentation. You know, you have to, I mean, you really have to be able to reflect back on what's going on in the environment inside the office.
How do you guard against that? How do you prepare to make sure that's not an issue when you're in front of a potential client?
How does an agency do that?
Yeah.
I would say that agencies shouldn't have to do that. I would argue it's the culture of the organization. It's the collaboration of the team if they're working together to begin with. Well, I mean, they should be well-oiled, not just simply rehearsed, but they should simply know how they're going to be presenting themselves. And they should understand what it takes to win the client and what it takes to sort of do the job on a daily basis. And that should sort of come through their pores as they present.
Well, it should. And the other thing, Robert, I think is, and this is probably the most difficult thing for an agency head or a senior executive in an agency to do, is not dominate the presentation, mm-hmm. himself or herself. Mm-hmm. Whether they're told not to do so in our process or not, and they shouldn't have to be told, they ought to know that, you know, their job is to sort of give the big picture and then shut up and let all his or her brilliant people sort of carry the day. You know, we've seen, you know, time and again where after an agency team has left the room and we sort of, you know, start talking with a client and everybody's filling out their scorecards, and they'll say, you know, so-and-so, she just wouldn't shut up and she kept interrupting the junior person, and I really wanted to hear what that, you know, because we do obviously require the people that are going to work on the account need to be in the presentation, and everybody knows the top guy or gal is not necessarily going to be full-time on their account, not even close.
We have counseled agencies not to bring in their CEO. And Steve knows I'm talking about one in particular who literally flew in from overseas, did other work, but came to sit in on the presentation. And he probably ruined it for his agency. And it really, I mean, it was all the chemistry. It was all the arrogance the CEO would bring to a table that really sort of destroyed it and sort of minimized what the staff could do and how the staff could interact with our client. We do a lot. We do our best to counsel and really sort of consult to agencies as well. We're getting paid by the client, but we want the agencies to put their best foot forward. And we say to agencies sometimes how they should be coming into the room, what they should be doing. And whenever an agency tells us they're going to be bringing in their president or their CEO, we say to them, we really strongly advise that you don't. They want to see your account team. They're not going to be impressed by having the, you know, the lead guy there. We're trying to help you with your best interest. But they walk in.
That means I get to stay home now. No more RFPs.
There you go. You know,
where's my rocking chair?
Congratulations. Exactly.
I love you guys.
There you go.
If you keep your sleeves rolled up, then okay. Potentially you can show how much work you'll be doing.
You could leave your CEO or president at home, or you could put them on a podcast and let them get all of that frustration out on a microphone.
That's right.
Probably right.
And these days you probably could whisper into a microphone and talk to your staff also.
That's right. Well, this has been really helpful. I feel so much better now. I've got an RFP I'm deciding this week whether to respond to or not. And some of this advice will be useful as I deliberate inside my dark cobweb-filled head. Any final thoughts? Either of you here? Anything you want to, other than, you know, hire us?
No, I think to the clients listening to your great podcast here, you know, if you, or next time you do an agency search, an RFP process, listen to what we've said in this conversation, replay it. You know, there's probably a better way to do it than you did it the last time.
It's valuable to reemphasize that even though Steve and I are being paid by the client, we advocate very much for the agency. And just as I mentioned in the last story I just said, we have our website is a wonderful resource with our blog to also explain to agencies how to get through some of the pitfalls of the process, for clients to educate them on the best way to find agencies. We really sort of want that resource out there for everyone. And we really do our best to try to make sure these agencies can really sort of get the job done. It reflects on us. And we also feel really, truly, it reflects on the industry if this is a good process. So we want everyone to be winners at the end of the day.
I see a hat in your future, making RFPs great again.
There you go. Red and white, huh? No.
You pick the colors, maybe a different combination.
Okay, got it.
Thanks for your time, gents.
Thank you very much, Robert.
We appreciate this, Robert. Thanks so much.